Please join me. Father in the heavens, we have a lot of lessons to learn here. We acknowledge that. I ask you with my brothers and sisters here to take the material I've prepared and put it on the right shelf for each of us. Put it in perspective for each of us that this message carries the weight it must carry according to each person's needs and the questions they have. I commit this all into your hands with my brothers and sisters and Yahshua always. Hallelujah and amen. You all be seated. But it looks like the youth and the kids have all the fun. Okay, I'm going to make an appeal to the technicians at the control booth in the center. Do you have a means of recording this? Could you please make sure this is recorded? Okay, thanks a lot, friends. Brothers and sisters, I'm Brother Michael Bannock from Fulton, Missouri, also from Chicago, Kalamazoo, Phoenix, Arizona, and parts unknown. I tell people I'm a traveling engineer. Sure hope things settle down for me. The title of my remarks today is Unknown Dimensions in Grace and Restoration Ministry. Sometimes we'll have questions about Yahweh's work rippling through our minds, questions which may border on doubt. My intention is to answer those questions, just certain questions. Grace and restoration ministry have two largely overlooked dimensions. And these things are going to be overlapping, maybe in ways you never thought of. Those of you who have known me for a long time will see some connection between this and other material I've presented. But that's because the truth as I know it, no, the truth as we know it, has many facets to it. And many of them are interrelated. These two aspects I want to discuss are blessings in the face of compromise, and number two, the need for enforcement. As I look across the landscape of the world of religion, I see these two topics do not get enough playtime, so I'm hoping to fill in the gap. First, blessings in the face of compromise. Common questions that you might have. Why are unqualified ministers able to accomplish so much? Or how can corrupt organizations accomplish so much? One common phenomenon in the world of religion where people get mixed up with a powerful yet corrupt ministerial outreach. And when the mask comes off and they find out what a horror they're involved with, some people are so traumatized They don't know where to go. Their insides are just gutted. They're turned inside out. Some of them seek therapy. I know people who've been down this path. This is usually affiliated with like cults or groups whose doctrines are really far out. Why is it that so often they accomplish so much? First, we're going to explore the grace that enables these seemingly wrong phenomena. We're going to go look at some obscure stories from the Old Testament. Maybe you know about these. But as far as grace, let's have some working definitions of grace. For the management of our salvation, our individual lives, and our spiritual walk, grace is the divine influence that leads us to virtue. There are places out there that will teach you that grace is a license to sin. But those of you, if you do a deeper study, especially in the New Testament, you'll find that grace is the enabling influence that empowers us to draw nigh to Yahweh. This applies to everyday life and spiritual growth. But then there's specific tasks that Yahweh lays before us. Call them what you want, projects, commitments, things to which we dedicate ourselves long term. Grace is the divine influence that leads you to accomplish Yah's will in spite of yourself. And this is for specific objectives. And that will be our focus here for a little while. As I flip through the slides here on the PowerPoint, it's funny. I tried real hard to get that aspect ratio to look like an envelope, like Randy asked me, and I know I did, but it still comes out looking like a box, like from the 1920s. Well, I was alarmed this morning to find out how hard it is to read that stuff way in the back. So I tried to make the fonts bold and white on blue. Well, I hope you can see it as we go. We're going to look at five case studies. Jacob steals the blessing. Jacob's speckled cattle. Then Solomon at the high place. Moses' child uncircumcised. And Moses and the rock. These are five case studies of people who seem to get away with defying Yahweh. Let's talk about Jacob steals the blessing. Now, you have to know your Bible to follow along this. Later on, we'll be doing some readings, but for now, we're going to be citing scriptures and citing events that we might remember once I bring them back to the surface. When it was time for Isaac to bless Esau, his oldest son, Jacob and his mother conspired to steal the blessing. Jacob disguises himself as Esau. Mom helps make that yummy stew for Dad to enjoy. Daddy Isaac can't see too well. Jacob sneaks in there, pretends to be Esau, and he gets the blessing. And Yahweh seems to go along with this. Why? You know, there are pockets of Christianity that endorse what Rebekah did to deceive her husband, to partner with Esau, to partner with Jacob, to deceive Dad and to steal the blessing. They say, oh, she had to do that. She had to do that. She knew her son would have the blessing. Why did Yahweh go along with this? Well, the answer is Yahweh had already decided long ago that Jacob would get the blessing. It's in Genesis 25:23, as Rebekah was delivering these two boys, the voice told her that the older would serve the younger. Yahweh already made up his mind that Jacob was going to get the blessing. Now, as a side note, when Jacob was older, he had to lay his hands in blessing on Joseph's sons. And when he did that, he crossed his hands and he put his right hand on the younger son. And Joseph said, no, you got it mixed up. And Israel, or Jacob, said, no, I know what I'm doing. I would love to have been there at that moment, because it was Yahweh's spirit that forced Jacob to cross his hands. At that moment in his life, Jacob realized he didn't have to steal the blessing from his daddy. Yahweh would have intervened and got the blessing to him just fine. There's so many of these stories in the Bible where people jump the gun, do things their way. They think Yahweh needs help. Yahweh needs my help. He needs me to lie. He needs me to fudge. He needs me to get a little cagey. Otherwise, his work won't go forward. Yes, Yahweh already decided he was going to bless Jacob. But because Jacob jumped the gun, ran ahead of Yahweh, defied Yahweh's laws in dishonoring his father, his behavior triggered a life of hardship and divine judgment. The danger we face is believing that Yahweh needed Jacob to lie and steal. As if to say, quote, my compromise made it happen. As though Yahweh needs your corrupt assistance. Yahweh's will shall be done. The question is, how hard will you make it on yourself? That's the real question. He's already decided a lot of the blessings he has in store for you. How hard are you going to make it on yourself? Also, I might add, how much could we help each other in fulfilling Yahweh's purpose in our lives? Let's talk about Jacob's speckled cattle. This story is very hard to read when you catch it in the Torah. Jacob, as you know, worked for his father-in-law, Laban, for a long time. And they had an agreement that Jacob would only get the speckled cattle, the ones that didn't look as nice. Now, I'm giving you the high points of this story, but that was basically the deal. I'll keep my cattle separated from yours. I only get the speckled cattle. And whenever the strong cattle were mating, Jacob would place speckled rods in the watering troughs that they were drinking out of. There was a superstition back then that if the cattle saw those kinds of rods where part of the bark was torn off, that they would produce offspring that were speckled. This was a superstition they had. There's absolutely no scientific basis for believing such a weird thing. So all these newborn cattle came out that were speckled. And so Jacob's thinking, okay, I got my speckled cattle. So he gets to take these strong cattle that just happened to be speckled, and they become his, according to the deal. Jacob's cattle count increased mightily as a result. Why? Again, Yahweh already decided to bless Jacob. It was already worked out. It was already in the plan. It was already, no matter what Jacob had done, he would have been blessed. Jacob erroneously thought his superstition triggered the cattle increase. In this case, there were no consequences, not that I know of, there are no consequences recorded for practicing such a superstitious act, but its apparent success delayed Jacob's repentance. Jacob did repent later in his life in the night incident where he wrestled with the angel. But how about you? Are you doing funny, goofy things in your life, thinking, oh, Yahweh's going to bless me if I put 3 drops of oil and water every day or some other thing like that? I mean, do you have superstitions in your life and you think, oh, I got to do this? I remember in the course of processing my late parents' possessions, my sisters were shocked at how rapidly I destroyed some of the religious paraphernalia in the collection. They were shocked. But I do not want anything outside of Yahweh to get credit for my blessings. And it'd be tempting to say, oh, my mom liked this thing, this, I don't even want to mention it, these devotional doodads that are common in certain branches of Christianity. I want only Yahweh to get credit for blessing me. Not some ritual, not some doodad, talisman, or anything like that. Let's talk about Solomon at the high place. Many high places existed in Israel in the time of Solomon. And the high places were condemned in Yah's word. And it's even mentioned again in 1 Kings 3:3. Well, that's the chapter where Solomon gets the wisdom. Solomon is at a high place. It says so explicitly. Yahweh appears to him. He asks for wisdom and he gets it. Why did he get the wisdom there? Why did Yahweh bless him at a high place? It would seem like an endorsement, wouldn't it? Like, well, he did it at a high place. I guess that's the place to go. Yahweh had already decided on the timing of the gift he had in store for Solomon. Yahweh already decided this is the time to reveal myself to Solomon. The question we must face is, might we use that blessing as an excuse for worshiping at high places? If you don't have enough spiritual discernment, you'll say, oh, worshiping at high places, yeah, that's a good thing. Hey, didn't Solomon get wisdom at a high place? There is danger in overinterpreting such blessings as divine, as though the blessings are divine approval for everything at the time of the blessing. There was some guy running around the country, around the Midwest anyway. Me and Elder Sam Graham saw him in Lansing, Michigan. Elder Graham, many of us know him up at the Michigan Assembly. He's very evangelistic. And I remember we went to this place called the Prophecy Club. I says, I'll go with you, Sam. No problem. He was piling up his suitcase with tracts and things to pass around. He was very evangelistic. Well, anyway, we go to this prophecy club, and some guy was claiming that the King James Bible is the only true Bible. And I tried to get through to the guy. I said, you know, everything you said about the King James Bible would still be true if you replace the Almighty's name there where it belonged. He didn't want to hear it. He felt the King James Bible was perfectly inspired and four square. There are several versions of the King James Bible. I'm not sure which one he had in mind. But somebody started to attack him with factual problems with the King James Bible. And this man, he stopped all the conversation and he said, you know, I almost took my life. I was sitting in an office in the back of a church in the suburbs of St. Louis, and I opened up my King James Bible and I found a verse that saved my life. He says, I almost committed suicide, but I was saved by this verse in the King James Bible. And you know, on the basis of that, he concluded the King James Bible was perfect. You know, and so these things happen. People overinterpret blessings. Oh, I can do no wrong. He's with me. Everything in the room is approved of heaven now because we've been blessed. Well, you might say that about high places if you read this story about Solomon. You'll say, maybe we should all go to high places and look for wisdom. There are stories like this all over the place in the Bible. I've just picked five. Here's a related story. Moses' child is uncircumcised. Now, Yahweh appeared to Moses early in the book of Exodus and gave him initial instructions for confronting Pharaoh. On the way to meet his brother Aaron, the angel of Yahweh met Moses and threatened to kill him because his son was uncircumcised. And his Midianite wife immediately discerned that it was their son's uncircumcised condition that created the risk. Sorry, it says decision up there. It's uncircumcised condition that created the risk. Now, I don't know how Zipporah understood this, but she knew at once her husband was going to die because the son was uncircumcised. So she immediately circumcised the boy and saved Moses' life. Very odd story, and a lot of people scratched their heads reading it. Here's a question for you. Might Moses think he was above the law, having a direct revelation while his son was uncircumcised? Yahweh's talking to him direct. The burning bush, the whole thing. They sang a song here a while ago, I Am. That I Am expression comes right from, I think it's like one chapter before this incident. Maybe Moses is thinking, ooh, I'm on a roll here. Nothing's going to stop me. I'm okay. What areas in your life are in need of reform? Do you interpret your blessings as a sign of divine endorsement? Ooh, baby, I can do no wrong. Man, these blessings are rolling in. Everything's fine. Really, now, are you able to predict the hour of judgment in your life? There's no way Moses could have anticipated that the hammer of judgment was going to fall while he was on his way to see his brother Aaron. If you read a few verses before this incident, by the way, you'll find that he took his wife and his son with him to go see Aaron. And only heaven knows what might have happened if his wife hadn't come along. The whole ministry would have been destroyed if his Midianite wife hadn't circumcised the boy. Now, Midianites are traceable to Abraham, too. So she knew about circumcision. Let's talk about Moses and the rock. It occurred to me that I think I mentioned this last year at this very same place. Moses once struck a rock and drew water out for the people. Yahweh told him, strike the rock and you get water out. Later in time, they needed water again, and Moses was instructed to speak over the rock to draw more water. And you find out later that he was supposed to bless Yahweh. Just talk over the rock, and the water would come out. Instead, Moses struck it twice, and the water came out. Now, observant Bible students read that story, and they say, it isn't exactly like Moses struck it twice. What happened is he struck it once, and nothing came out. And he struck it again, and then Yahweh gave in. Now, the people observing this, they would say, wow, Moses is pushing all the right buttons. We got water again. Moses did it right. But in fact, what happened is Moses did Yahweh's work Moses' way. Not Yahweh's way. He did it his way. Let's pause. Let's tap the brake here. How many ministries are there worldwide that are doing Yahweh's work their way? Ask yourself that. I would say an awful lot of them are doing Yahweh's work their way. Not Yahweh's way, their way. And furthermore, they seem to accomplish a lot. If you are not careful, I guess this is for any of us who are trying to assess what Yahweh is doing out there, and this is a warning also for those of my friends here in the ministry. You might think because things are falling into place, letters and phone calls are pouring in, checks are coming in the mail, you might think, ooh, baby, I'm on a roll, nothing's going to stop me now. You too have to ask yourself if you're doing Yahweh's work Yahweh's way, or you're doing it your way. It's hard to sort this stuff out sometimes because the people there before Moses, they got the water they needed, didn't they? How did they know? Moses was punished severely for this. He begged Yahweh, please let me go in the promised land, please, please. And one day Yahweh just tell him, shut up, I don't want to hear any more about it. Maybe some of you as parents have gotten fed up with your children. You knew, we're not going to change the decision on this. You were naughty. The punishment will stand. It is for our benefit that Moses was punished like this. Because Yahweh's telling us through Moses, you do his holy work your way instead of Yah's way, you might get results. Yeah. You might score a few points, but the punishment awaiting you might be indescribable. Questions, is your ministry successful? Is everything in order behind the scenes? Do you interpret your success as a sign of divine approval for all things? These are questions to ask yourself. There's others, we can talk about them over lunch if you want, where people seemingly were blessed, but they were far from Yahweh's will. I'm going to summarize this first part of the material. If Yahweh decides to do a work involving you, he may be forced to work around you. Do not interpret success of Yah's work as a go-ahead approval of your compromises and errors. And I should have worded this differently, because it applies to ministries worldwide. When you assess a ministry, it's on TV, radio, internet, you should never interpret their success as a go-ahead approval of all their compromises and errors. This book here, this wonderful book, is a terrific filter for sorting that stuff out. It's a crying shame we have to live with. Well, all our lives we've had to live with these compromised ministries still feeding us, still getting results. But might these facts explain why so many religious organizations seem to make divinely approved progress, yet they are sorely lacking in needed reforms? Of course, that's exactly what happened. We'll find Yahweh's explanation documented in Isaiah 55, verse 10 and 11. I couldn't squeeze it all on the view graph here, so I'm going to go flipping to that passage, Isaiah 55. Well, this is one of those really important verses. It explains a lot. It explains a lot of things we have questions about. Isaiah 55, 10 and 11. For as the rain cometh down, and the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth, and maketh it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater. So shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereunto I sent it. And when you see a ministry that's sorely in need of reform, seemingly accomplishing much, it's because Yahweh is fulfilling his word there. He will prosper his word wherever it goes. You should never use that, though. This is a dead bullseye. Isaiah's explanation is a dead bullseye for what we see all over. We should never let our blessings hinder us from reform. I guess I'm doing okay. By the way, getting back to Solomon, whenever I cover that, it's interesting. Yahweh did not tell Solomon when he gave him wisdom. He didn't say, listen, bud, you have a problem with the women. You have a weakness for women. Yahweh didn't tell him that. He just said, obey my laws, read the book, do what I tell you. He always points them back to the law. I don't know why Yahweh withheld that warning from Solomon, but there must be a divine purpose in that. I'm just guessing. I think if Yahweh told Solomon about one particular weakness in his life, he might have focused on that to the detriment of the others. And I do think the best advice you can give anybody is to say, keep my laws, do my statutes, read the book, you know, burn it in your heart. You know, just do what's in the book. Because you can't go wrong pointing people to the book. And finally, in summary, you have no idea when the hammer of judgment will fall. You don't know when it's going to hit. I hate to cover this kind of thing, but some of us have associations with ministries prior to this experience here. And there are times when the hammer of judgment falls, and it's like a whirlwind. You don't want to be there. You don't want to put yourself in a position where you've got compromises, obvious compromises at play, and it's just a matter of time when it blows up in everybody's face. You're better off doing what he says in all dimensions. We're going to the second dimension, the need for enforcement of Yah's laws. The reforms of Hezekiah, Josiah, and Nehemiah were characterized by lots of action and building. Modern ministries like citing these great stories for support of the brick and mortar game. This is where, it's very common in the world of religion, it's where a pastor will say, hey, let's build a new assembly hall, or they call a church. Let's put a copper dome on the building. And they're not teaching people anything. They're just building a building. There's no instruction, no discipleship. They never talk about Yah's laws. They celebrate the fact that they got a new building. But they don't celebrate Yah's greatness, his laws, his teachings, his salvation. And this is really an old game, friends. I don't know how much you guys have been around, but it's very common for pastors who want to create false excitement to look to Hezekiah, Josiah, and Nehemiah, and Ezra, and Nehemiah for the brick-and-mortar game, but there's no other reforms. Nothing. Just we build a building. That's it. Nothing else. Well, Yahweh understands we need places to meet. He knows that. But I would celebrate the fact that the individual temples coming to services are being edified. And the exposition of Yah's law be underscored. Very few understand the enforcement of Yah's law at play in these restoration stories in the Bible. So in kind of a left-handed attempt to make up for what others have failed to do, I'm just going to skim and review some highlights. Let's see, I'm not going to go there. We're going to pause on this view graph for a while. I'm just going to look at some highlights of Ezra and Nehemiah and Hezekiah and Josiah. I don't want to keep you sitting here hearing scriptures all the time, and I don't want anybody to drift off on me. But I had wrote down some notes I wanted to turn to. Let's look at Hezekiah, 2 Chronicles 29. I'll just be reading selected parts. Let's see how far I want to go with this. Hezekiah is described in 2 Chronicles 29, verse 1. Hezekiah began to reign when he was 5 and 20 years old, and he reigned 9 and 20 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of Yahweh, according to all that David his father had done. He, in the first year of his reign, in the first month, opened the doors of the house of Yahweh and repaired them. Okay, repaired them. That's building. And he brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them together into the east street. And he said unto them, Hear me, you Levites. Sanctify now yourselves and sanctify the house of Yahweh, Elohim of your fathers, and carry forth the filthiness out of the holy place. For our fathers have trespassed and done that which is evil in the eyes of Yahweh, our Elohim, and have forsaken him, and have turned away their faces from the habitation of Yahweh and turned their backs. Also they have shut up the doors of the porch and put out the lamps, and have not burned incense nor offered burnt offerings in the holy place unto the Elohim of Israel. Wherefore the wrath of Yahweh was upon Judah and Jerusalem, and he hath delivered them into trouble, to astonishment and to hissing, as ye see with your eyes. For lo, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and our daughters and our wives are in captivity for this. Now it is in mine heart to make a covenant with Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. My sons, be not now negligent, for Yahweh hath chosen you to stand before him, to serve him, that you should minister unto him and burn incense. And it talks about how they went into the house of Yahweh and cleansed it. And jumping to verse 20 of this chapter, Hezekiah the king rose early and gathered the rulers of the city and went up to the house of Yahweh. And they brought seven bullocks and rams and lambs, and all these sacrifices are described here for the next several verses. The Institute of the Music Ministry, he set Levites in the house of Yahweh with cymbals, with psalteries, and with harps, according to the commandment of David and of Gad, the king's seer, and Nathan the prophet, for so was the commandment of Yahweh by his prophets. And the Levites stood with the instruments of David and the priests with trumpets. Oh, I love that. And Hezekiah commanded to offer the burnt offerings upon the altar. Verse 29, all the congregation worshipped, and the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded, and all this continued until the burnt offering was finished. So they had quite a time there. In chapter 30, they celebrated the Passover. They couldn't get it done in time for the first month, so they did it in the second month. And it was a tremendous feast. I want to jump ahead to chapter 31, just one verse there. Now when all this was finished, all Israel that were present went out to the cities of Judah and brake the images in pieces and cut down the groves and threw down the high places and the altars out of all Judah and Benjamin, in Ephraim also and Manasseh, until they had utterly, I underscore utterly, destroyed them all. Then all the children of Israel returned every man to his possession into their own cities. They were not content to just have a good feast. They swung into action and did all this destruction contained in one verse. Try to imagine. I love my sisters, okay? I love them. But they were kind of horrified at the zeal with which I destroyed the things, the spiritual things that were owned by my father and mother. Can you imagine the outcry, the outrage, when the people came home from the feast and destroyed all these idols in high places? Hey, what are you doing over there? We used to pray over there. Hey, we had a lot invested in those idols over there. Hey, my grandpa used to sacrifice at that high place. Can you imagine the social upheaval that was triggered by this? Now, the chronicler here only covers it in one verse. But that's an example of the house cleaning nobody talks about. They like to talk about the big parties, the big reforms, the big feasts, repairing the temple. But the stuff that hurts, the stuff that costs us time, money, and energy, the stuff that might tick off people who don't see the light. Let's jump to 2 Kings chapter 22. We'll spend a few minutes looking at Josiah. Josiah was the last great reform before the fall of Judah. Let's see, I'm going to read just seven verses from 2 Kings 22. Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jedidah, the daughter of Adiah and Boskath. And he did that which was right in the sight of Yahweh, and walked in all the way of David his father, and turned not aside to the right hand or to the left. And it came to pass in the 18th year of King Josiah that the king sent Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, and the son of Meshullam, the scribe, to the house of Yahweh, saying, "Go up to Hilkiah, the high priest, that he may sum the silver which is brought into the house of Yahweh, which the keepers of the door have gathered of the people, and let them deliver it to the hand of the doers of the work that have oversight of the house of Yahweh, and let them give it to the doers of the work which is in the house of Yahweh to repair the breaches of the house." Okay, here you go, building again. "Unto carpenters and builders and masons to buy timber and hewn stone to repair the house. Albeit there was no reckoning made with them of the money that was delivered into their hand, because they dealt faithfully." You know, there's a saying in the business world, everything moves with the speed of trust. If I can trust you, we get things done quicker because I don't have to check up on you. That must have been a honey of a reform. To smell the sawdust, to see the clouds of dust from the workplaces. This is the famous episode where they found the book of the law in the temple. And in chapter 23, verse 4, they talk about a Passover they kept. And, I'm sorry, after, a little later they kept the Passover. I'm jumping to 23, verse 4. "And the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the keepers of the door, to bring forth out of the temple of Yahweh all the vessels that were made for Baal, and for the grove, and for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside of Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron, and carried the ashes of them into Bethel." You can be sure there were Baal worshippers there who were hopping mad to see that stuff removed. It's nice to talk about refurnishing the temple, making it pretty, a new coat of paint, new knickknacks hanging on the walls. But to remove the idolatrous stuff, you can be sure there were some people hopping angry about this. "And he put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places, in the cities of Judah, and in the places around about Jerusalem. And them also that burned incense unto Baal, to the sun, and to the moon, and to the planets, and to all the host of heaven." Can you imagine the social pushback? You know, I'm not reading everything here, and that's on purpose. But one of these two kings, I forget whether it was Hezekiah or Josiah, it says he burned and destroyed the idols of his mother. Can you imagine a sibling saying, "That was mom's. That was mom's. You're not supposed to do that. That's mom's." And you say, "No, this is foreign to Yahweh's spirit. This has got to go." We'll spend a little more time here with Josiah. It was an electrifying revival. Let's jump to verse 19 in chapter 23. "And all the houses also of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria," now he's pushing north, "which the kings of Israel had made to provoke Yahweh to anger, Josiah took away, and did to them according to all the acts that he had done in Bethel. And he slew all the priests of the high places," man, what a mess, "that were upon the altars, and burned men's bones upon them, and returned to Jerusalem." Okay, this is where they did the Passover now. Transitioning to that. And then going to verse 24. "Moreover, the workers with familiar spirits and the wizards and all the images and the idols and all the abominations that were spied in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem did Josiah put away, that he might perform the words of the law, which were written in the book that Hilkiah the priest found in the house of Yahweh." He read Yahweh's book, and he said, well, it was read to him, and forgive me, I'm not sure how much of it he read himself and how much was read to him, but this was discovered in the temple, and he responded to it. Instead of saying, well, I'm blessed, my heart's already in the right place, we don't want to upset anybody, he instituted these reforms. Finally, we'll look at Nehemiah a little bit. Chapter 2 of Nehemiah. You'll find this. You'll find the Ezra and Nehemiah book shortly after, right after Chronicles. Let's look at Nehemiah 2. See what. Nehemiah chapter 2 through 6 is an exciting account of how they repaired the walls. It always puzzled me why the Jews rebuilt the temple before they built the wall. But it is very common for ministers who want to do a lot of building to read through Nehemiah's account, chapter 2 through 6. But there's other things they won't mention. While it's exciting to get the brick and mortar game going, they won't talk about reforms. Let's look at Nehemiah chapter 13. In particular, let's jump to verse 23. In those days also saw I Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. And their children spoke half in the speech of Ashdod and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. And I contended with them and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair. And made them swear by Elohim, saying, you shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourselves. This was drastic action. To pluck out their hair? You know, like in the Three Stooges, you know, plucking handfuls of hair out? What stirred him up like that? What? Because he had known what happened before. Going back to the time of Solomon, marrying all these foreign women and bringing these pagan ideas right back into the holy city. Only in the last year did I discover that Yahweh speaks against paganism a lot. But the day comes when it stops. When our people came back from Babylonian captivity, it was no longer an issue after that. Nehemiah put his foot down. And from that point forward, the Israelites never had a problem with paganism. Paganism became an issue when the good news was brought to the Gentiles. I'm almost done, friends. I'm going to point you to Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 15. In those days saw I in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves and lading donkeys, as also wine grapes and figs and all manner of burdens which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals. There dwelt men of Tyre also therein, which brought fish and all manner of ware, and sold on the Sabbath unto the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said unto them, what evil is this that you do and profane the Sabbath? Did not your fathers thus, and did not our Elohim bring all this evil upon us and upon this city? Yet you bring more wrath upon Israel by profaning the Sabbath. He contended with the nobles. I'll give you guys a little secret. You know where boldness comes from? It's common for a man to wonder, am I being bold enough, standing for the right things? The secret to boldness is to know that what you're standing for is right before heaven. When you know that what you stand for is right before heaven, when you have the facts, you've done the homework, you got it all lined up, it's amazing how natural boldness comes forth. Nehemiah didn't even flinch with these characters looking back at him. I might have something from Ezra here, I might not. Just give me a moment to check my notes. But as I thumb there, it is indeed a phenomenon where if a pastor in an everyday congregation wants to get excitement, he says, let's do a building. Let's have a building plan. But they never talk about these reforms that these real reformers found the strength to institute. Well, I think that's going to be it as far as the Ezra and Nehemiah story. When they built the temple, they were careful about who was allowed to work on it, and I found that very interesting. The need for enforcement. Why might you avoid enforcement? If you're in leadership in your home or your assembly, well, we all have a tendency to defend people, places, and things that make us feel good. People we like, places we like to go, things we want to do, and things we have. We like to defend these things. And often, the people, it's very difficult to institute reform because of people barriers. This is a, I only got two more slides, including this one. I'd like you to take a breath and follow along with me on this, because I'm going to touch a nerve here. If a reform must be instituted, I'm probably going to interact with somebody who needs reform. Either going to have to stop what they're doing or get out, or I have to destroy what they made. Why would we flinch? Because we like them? Maybe they're a heavy contributor to our work. How about they have a convincing story? Now, that's a catch-all. Yahweh put this on my heart. He told me to do this. He told me to institute this. He told me to talk this up. He told me to make this. And it could be anything. It could be something idolatrous. It could be a forbidden relationship. When people are caught in moral impurity in a religious context, they often say that they really believed that Yahweh brought them together. Yes, we took matters into our own hands, but we thought the Almighty would see us through. We read Psalms together. We prayed together. Surely this will be okay. And I've interviewed people myself. When I saw this in books on Christian counseling, I went and asked people who I'd known have fallen into this trap over the decades. And it's kind of consistent. When people are in that realm, they think they're above Yahweh's law. And if they look at you, you have a convincing, if they have a convincing story, they look back at you and you say, hey, you two shouldn't be living together. They'll say, oh no, he put this on our hearts. Sometimes it's too much trouble to institute reform. Sometimes the people you need to rebuke are popular. There's a lot of people behind him. Or perhaps they are my kin. It's very hard to rebuke your own kin. That priest in Shiloh, I forget his name now, but up in Shiloh, before the ark was taken from Shiloh and moved to Jerusalem, I think it was Eli. Is it Eli up in Shiloh? He didn't restrain his kids from abusing their ministerial office. Those of you who know me well know I've done a lot of research into restoration type groups. And one of the primary speed bumps for them is when one of their kids or one of their relatives do evil and the leadership will not rebuke them. So we have two sides of this thing that I've been discussing, and I'm almost done. One is that if we are doing something wrong and we're blessed, we cannot assume the blessing as an endorsement from Yahweh. The call to reform always begins with things in this book. And secondly, if we are in a position of leadership, whether in our homes, our families, or organizations, enforcing Yahweh's law has often been the missing ingredient. Now, I shouldn't have to say this, but Yahshua promises us success in getting the speck out of our brother's eye if we get the log out of our own eye. I hate to make this so self-referential, like it always comes back to you, but if you want to be a successful reformer, you yourself have to reform yourself first. You yourself have to get on track, get with Yahweh's game, do things his way, so that if you're part of his answer, your words will carry weight. In summary, the unknown dimensions in grace and restoration ministry is misinterpreting blessings as divine approval. If you're struggling with your feelings about a group you used to be with, this is the answer. Yahweh's work goes on regardless of what they do. What's important is what's Yahweh doing with you. And number two, the unwillingness to enforce Yah's law is a continuing problem in the world of religion. You better do it in your personal lives before you get to doing it, before you'll find success doing it in your families and in your assemblies. I hope I've given you some answers to long-standing questions. This material is the result of me trying to answer questions about this, how Yahweh works. And I'll always be happy to talk with you more about it over mealtime or something. Where's the Brother Terry? I'm going to hand it back over to you now. You've been real patient with me. Thanks for your attention, friends.